This is Turn One Thoughtsies. I'm Aaron.
And I'm Zach.
And this is episode 68, Sequencing and Sideboarding, No Clever Title. It's a very, very nuts and bolts episode. We're going to cover Baltimore. We're going to go over contest results. We got a shout out. Zach's going to talk about leveling up. I'm going to talk about tech and sideboarding. And then we're going to call a judge. And then we're going to put a bow on it. And hopefully the information presented will lead you to victory. That is our goal.
Yeah, I'm in for it. Let's get some W's.
Yeah, let's get some W's. All right, so contest results. We got a bevy, if you will, of some really great tribal brews. And this is the Spell Pierce Playmat contest from the last episode. And so we ended up getting... the one that we picked was a Horrors tribal deck, which had a bunch of... It was Thing in the Ice, Phyrexian Obliterator, Phyrexian Revoker, Spellskite. Like, it had all the things, right? It had two drops, Spellskite just, like, randomly hoses decks. Like, Infect is a thing again.
Sure.
Same, like, Phyrexian Revoker, same thing.
Dude, look, you find a way to put Phyrexian Obliterator into, like, a three-color deck, I'm in. That's it. That's all you need to know.
Yeah.
That's what's up.
Unclaimed territory. Four caverns, four unclaimed territories. Naming Horror, there you go. You already, at that point, they're just gravy. Four black is not even an issue. And then Fatal Push, Remand... standard disruption package, Serum Visions, Counter Squall, just good stuff all around. So
Thing in the Ice is awesome in this deck, by the way. It's kind of like a pseudo Lord effect where it's like not really a Lord because it's not like pumping your other horrors, but like it is a Lord because it like bounces everything that's not a horror, which is sweet.
Yeah, it's just it's like two mana. Well, I guess technically it's like two. Assuming you cast four one-mana spells to flip it, I guess technically it's like a six-mana upheaval, but, like, upheaval's really good, so...
Yeah, in fact, generally game-winning when it happens.
Yeah, so I'm pretty ready to pay six mana for upheaval. And then also you get, like, a hasty 7-8, and your obliterators are still on the field, and they had Hunted Horrors in here. I don't know if Hunted Horror is, like... great because there's no Torpor effect and like no Trick Bind or anything like that.
Well, you have Thing in the Ice to bounce the little token guys.
Oh, clever.
Yep. It is pretty hot.
All right, so I was wrong. That is pretty great. So the winner, Boris Fishman, at your option. We can sign it if you want. Or not, that's fine too. And we'll get that all figured out and get it mailed out. So
absolutely,
thank you for the thank you for the horrors.
Yeah, congrats.
Thanks for the
man.
Horrors. Thanks for the horrors, buddy.
also appropriate because it was around Halloween, so
yes,
just very even very on theme for the week.
Topical.
I will say though, I'm a little bit sad because we didn't have any sweet golem lists. I was hoping.
They don't exist. Like I said, if you want to play Worst Tron, we can brew that up. We can play it on stream. Like, there's a ton of Worst Tron decks.
Oh, I've tried, man. I've tried to play the golems, and they aren't good. But I was hoping someone would have figured it out, and I just, you know, someone figured it out without me or something.
Doesn't they play Precursor Golem in, like, Vintage Shops or something ridiculous like that?
They do play Precursor Golem in Vintage Shops.
Yikes.
I don't know if you've ever Searing Blazed a Precursor Golem, but that's pretty sweet.
I have not.
Yeah.
I've never been involved in a game in which a Precursor Golem had been resolved. Bam. All right. Boris, you have been emailed. I did it specifically right now because I would forget, because that's the kind of person I am. I just love a lot going on. Shout out the Proven Combatants podcast hosted by the Cats, Chantel, Autumn, Teresa, and Sarah. Brand new podcast. They just put out the first episode, and they are off to a good start.
What I do know is that they're all very good. And
yes,
they are, you know, if you are the type of person that likes listening to podcasts, which is pretty likely because you're listening to ours, then, you know, it's worth throwing this one into the stable of podcasts, if you will, you know?
Yes, absolutely.
Put it in your iTunes library and give it a listen once or twice if you've got some time.
Yes. So as far as I know, right now they're definitely on the Constructed Criticism website. They should also be on iTunes by now. I know they're working on MTGcast, so if you're listening to us through MTGcast, they should be on there shortly. Other services as they become available, but definitely on the website, and should be on iTunes. So definitely give them a listen. They are great. And all excellent players. So you could learn something from them. I certainly did. So let's talk about Baltimore. You are going to Baltimore. I am not going to Baltimore. I am going to be at PAX Unplugged, which I think is the same weekend.
It is the same weekend. That sounds sweet, by the way, but
yeah, I think it's going to be cool. I was, there was a hot minute where I was going to go to Baltimore, and then I was like, and I decided to do this instead. But for anybody that is going to be at PAX Unplugged, I will be there as well. Just sort of tooling around, probably playing Iconic Masters drafts could be like probably where I will be most often. And then obviously if there's modern events, I will be there to, probably rack some people or I don't know, play Jund. That's what I've been doing. I've been testing like Jund variants.
Dude, you can never go wrong with Jund variants. Just never.
Well, like Jund aggro.
Wait, let me rephrase. You can never go wrong with Jund variants, provided you have one Hazoret in the list.
Correct. Yeah, Hazoret's so super real. If you're not playing Hazoret in Jund, you are doing it wrong currently. Yeah, I tested Kitesail Freebooter, just like didn't work. So far, I'm like 10 matches in with Deadeye Tracker in the one drop slot, and so far I really like it. So like Explore is an insane mechanic, and just like eating your opponent's graveyard two cards at a time, and you can use it to like set up your Bob triggers and draw extra lands. Like you can basically cut a land if you're playing Deadeye Tracker, and I just really like it. I don't know if it is good. Like Jund is like the ultimate good stuff deck, so I have not established yet if his stuff is good enough, but I have high hopes based on my play experience so far. I probably will give it another 15 or so matches before I like put it in the definitely yes, maybe, or no column. That Kitesail Freebooter unfortunately ended up in the no column. Just couldn't hang with the other like best cards ever printed kind of thing.
No, he's more of a synergy card.
Yeah.
He needs some help.
So, the anticipated metagame for Baltimore, you had sort of put up an expected decks in our script. I pulled a list from Modern Nexus based on the last regionals results. And this isn't really... the way that they break down the tier system is sort of nuanced, but it's really kind of focusing on what is winning, not necessarily what people are playing. So Affinity, Jeskai Control has been doing really well. Storm, obviously. Grixis Death Shadow sort of popped its head back up because I think people just kind of were sleeping on it for a little bit. Eldrazi Tron, still very good. Counters Company. Infect is back in a big way. I think people just kind of forgot that it existed or assumed that like Fatal Push had destroyed the archetype. They're playing Jace Vryn's Prodigy now to like defend against other aggressive decks and also fill their yard for Become Immense and Flashback like pump spells. Pretty great. Humans, since busting on the scene, has become very popular because it's extremely frustrating to play against. it just is. Like, it's so aggressive and so disruptive that like it is hard for a traditional like mid-range deck to keep up with it, and people aren't really running a lot of meaningful board wipes right now. Like, I don't think humans could exist in the old, like, pre-Eldrazi, like, red-green Tron world because they were just running four main deck Pyroclasms.
Well, the other thing, too, about that deck is that it has multiple different sweeper effects, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like, you know, you've got Ostone, you've got Ugin, you've got Pyroclasm, and that's kind of what that deck is good against, or is poor against, I should say, is differently named effects that essentially do the same thing.
Right.
Yep. So, you know, there's only one deck in the entire format I can think of that is running multiple sweepers with different names. And that deck tends to be a very, very bad matchup for humans, as it turns out. So, yeah.
There you go. Blue-white control. I think if you're going to play a blue-white X control deck, I think Jeskai is certainly the better option, and the results kind of bear that out. So, I mean, if you're hellbent on playing blue white control, then play blue white control. That's fine. Just Jeskai is probably qualitatively better for what you want to do.
Yeah, I mean, that one is close to me. Like I said, I've been playing a lot of Jeskai recently, and I really like it. If you told me I could play a control deck, I would snap, jump on it, and say, yes, sign me up, because, as you know, I love control, but I don't believe that control decks exist in Modern. I just don't think it's smart to register one. I don't think you should realistically play one, and I think that if you are going to try and play a blue counterspell-ish deck, you need to have an I win button. You have to have one. You can't drag out the game and let card draw win like you can in standard, because there just isn't good card draw in the format. There, you don't have, you know, this general engine type thing. You don't have great answers for everything. You will get decks to go over the top of you in Tron. It's just not a great spot to be. So,
well, you can't control everything, basically.
Yeah, exactly. But in this format, you can control, you know, the first 5, 6, 7 or so turns, and then set up your I win scenario, right? And I think right now we're seeing two different kinds of control decks, and they're both faring much better than classic blue-white in Jeskai Geist, which is more of an aggro deck, honestly. And then sure. There is blue-red / Jeskai Through the Breach, which is making a huge resurgence. And I like both of those decks more just based on the fact that you have this I win button. You have something you're trying to do. It's not, I'm just trying to extend the game. It's, I'm trying to set up this scenario, and when this happens, I win.
Right. I mean, Breach, like, I played this match recently, and I squeaked out a win on the back of, like, game one, it was just disruption, because I had Thought Seizes for their Breaches, and then I was able to eat their graveyard with Deadeye Tracker, so they didn't have, like, access to Snapcasters and stuff like that. But, yeah, game one is just, like, all in on the combo, get an Emrakul, win the game. And then game two, depending on what they're playing, like, obviously I was on Jun, so they were like, oh, okay. No attrition. Like they tried to break the attrition game. And so they sided into like young pyromancers, totally sided out the combo and just went for like a value blue red like pyromancer spells deck, and that was a lot harder to deal with, honestly. Like taking your Through the Breach away is very easy for Jund. Like trying to manage like young pyromancer and young pyromancer tokens and like all of your stuff getting bolted, and you can't stick a Lily because they've got two lightning bolts in hand, plus they have card selection with Desolate Lighthouse, and like it all adds up to something that's very difficult to stay on top of. So I don't know if I would recommend it unless you already have the cards and you just really love Through the Breach, which is a fine card. It's a card that I dislike, but as a game one, like gotcha win con, it's not bad.
Well, the thing I like about the deck is that it is like Splinter Twin in the sense that it's playing like a very powerful, you know, proven shell outside of the Through the Breach Emrakul package. You know, the Snap, Bolt, Blood Moon, all of those have been proven very powerful in Twin. They were missing the actual, you know, Deceiver Exarch Twin part, the I win two card combo. But, you know, Through the Breach Emrakul gives them that. Now, obviously, they're not as good as having these just, you know, slightly bad but playable creatures that Twin had, like, because the pieces aren't great on their own. But what they do is allow you to be more flexible, right? Like you just said, they bring in this, you know, Young Pyromancer Spells package, and it gives you this spot where, when your shell's bad, you can change it. You can adapt it with only a few pieces from your sideboard. That was always kind of the power in Twin was, you know, against unfair decks, you're this Twin combo deck. Against fair decks, you're this grindy blue-red control deck. And this deck can kind of do the same thing. I've actually been advocating for Jeskai Breach recently, that's playing Nahiri in the sideboard, as a different sort of I win, but also like good in a fair matchup type deal.
Sure.
Because, you know, Nahiri, like, you already have the Emrakul in your deck, so you don't need to board in Emrakuls. You can just board in two or three Nahiris, take out, you know, some number of Through the Breaches, some number of Emrakuls, and then Nahiri just is the combo by itself. You just gotta, you know, play it. And then, you know, Nahiri can, you know, minus kill a creature, maybe eat a pesky enchantment or artifact or whatever. So I like that, but the point here is that you don't really want to dirtle, and I mean, you just can't afford to in Modern right now. You're gonna get someone going over the top of you with Urza lands. So,
yeah. So then the tail end was Abzan, which I assume is just regular old Abzan mid range, and Burn, because Burn is always a thing. Don't think there was anything. Oh, you had like Scapeshift, Titan Shift on your list.
Yeah, well,
I think everything else is the same.
Yeah, I think generally those are the decks we're looking out for, right? The ones you just read off. But I wanted to mention something different about Baltimore in specific, I guess.
Okay.
I'm not sure if we mentioned already, but Baltimore is a team event. So that means it's team constructed. You have one player playing Standard, one player playing Modern, one player playing Legacy. It's three-player teams. And generally, in these teams, the person playing whatever format they're playing is going to be a specialist of that format. Now, that's not always true for every team, right? But, you know, in general, you can assume that the person playing Standard on their team is probably the best Standard player on that team. The person playing Modern on their team is probably the best Modern player on their team. Or maybe they're not the best on their team, but they are, you know, a specialist of the format they're in. And that tends to be the most true in Legacy, but that also applies very strongly to Modern. There's a very strong correlation of the Modern player on the team being a specialist in a type of deck, right? So that doesn't necessarily change the metagame, because anybody who plays Modern could just be the Modern player on their team. So you essentially can still see any deck you would normally see in a Modern event. Like, that's not changing anything. But what you can kind of assume is that the, you know, there's three people on the team. So, like, if somebody's specialty is, like, I don't know, generic unplayable modern deck that they just play for fun and somebody uses a specialty as affinity, well, it's more likely that the modern player is the affinity player. So in this scenario, you can kind of assume that it is the entire modern metagame, but it's weighted much, much more heavily towards top-tier decks. Which is why we kind of listed off these top 10 or so decks. And
right.
I mean, you're still going to have your burn player. You're still going to have your scapeshift player. These are decks that are maybe not top tier right now, but, you know, top tier recently enough that, you know, it could very well be assumed that, you know, one of the players on their team is like a scapeshift specialist. They could be playing scapeshift because it's just a popular archetype.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means for the actual event is that you want to pick a deck that's well positioned within the top tier, as opposed to a deck that is just better against the field in general, which might be a little confusing in modern, but generally in modern, the way to be the best against the field is to just play the best get you dead, I win as quickly as possible deck. That's why we see Storm, that's why we see Affinity, that's why we see Burn always tend to do fairly well. But here, you know, we aren't going to, you're not as likely to see, you know, get paired up against Taking Turns or, you know, I don't know, Green Devotion, like these random decks that are, you know, are very powerful. They're very good at what they do, but, you know, have holes. And, you know,
if somebody shows up to Baltimore with Taking Turns, like, I have a lot of questions.
I mean, I would agree with you, but then again, like, it could just be a guy with four, you know, quad sleeve deck who's just the Taking Turns specialist, and then it can happen.
Well, it happened once.
It did happen once. I agree. But the other thing, too, about this is that you do have two teammates, so you can have a modern deck that is losing repeatedly, you know, progress through the tournament in the winner's bracket, if you will.
Sure.
So,
but I also, I feel like maybe the other people on your team are going to be like, hey, we don't want to have to carry you, so could you perhaps play a real deck?
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. That is fair. And and that's kind of what I'm getting at, is that you're more likely to see tier 1 decks because it's three people making the deck decision, right? It's not, you know, and I've seen this before, I stay up until 3 a.m., register my deck list, wake up, and I'm playing this whatever I registered at 3 a.m. last night pile today. I don't think that's as likely to happen in this event.
That only works in Legacy and only if you are playing check pile.
Sure, but it, like, I, you know, I've seen Todd Anderson do it. One of my friends has done it and done well at an event, so it's not, you know, unheard of. I wouldn't recommend it, but
sure,
it is something that happens at events. And like I said, for here, it's not going to be that. So the thing that this allows you to do, though, is actually metagame for modern events, which doesn't typically happen, right? Like, it's very, very hard to metagame for a modern event where you could just see the field, right? Like in an individual event. But for instance, the last team event I played in, my teammate, who's our modern player, was playing Ad Nauseam. He's you know, one of my friends is an Ad Nauseam specialist. He plays, or he, at least up until this point, he had been playing Ad Nauseam for 3 or 4 years, kind of nonstop. And this was right when Death Shadow was breaking out. So we said, hey, let's metagame for Death Shadow. Why don't you play Leyline of Sanctity in the main deck? And we are aware that this is going to make you generically worse against the field, because there are decks that having Leyline of Sanctity in your main deck is just a joke against.
Yes.
But there are other decks where it's like, you know, just a stone cold I win the game card, and you just have that in your opening hand on game one. So we got I remember one specific judge call against the burn player that was pretty good, but that situation came up where we were like, hey, let's metagame for this event. We're gonna put the ley lines in, let's see what happens. And as it turned out, it did make him worse against the general field. So, you know, rounds 1 through 6 ish, he was struggling, but you know, we played pretty high-tiered standard and legacy decks and was generally able to carry him through the earlier rounds, so that by the time we got to day 2 and later in day 1, well, when he started seeing a bunch of Death Shadow decks, it was just, you know, stone-cold nightmare for these Death Shadow decks to play against a combo deck that they can't interact with.
Mm.
And Right. As it worked out, he carried us through day two. So it is viable, and because you know that these decks are going to be, you're more likely to see these, this popular deck, these tier two or these tier one and two decks, you can metagame for them. So I would suggest not going overboard. My Leyline of Sanctity example is may seem extreme, but when you already take into consideration that Ad Nauseam plays Leyline of Sanctity in its own board anyway, it was really more of just a, hey, let's take four of its sideboard slots, put it in the main deck, let's put four main deck cards in the sideboard type deal.
Right.
And, you know, it worked out. But what that allows you to do for this event is maybe you change two or three sideboard cards to really help you in those tier one matchups. Maybe you don't think you're going to see a graveyard deck. Maybe instead of, you know, playing the two pieces of token graveyard hate you would normally, maybe you get rid of all of them. Or, you know, maybe you're particularly scared of Affinity at this event, and instead of playing, you know, three pieces of Artifact Hate, well, now you're playing four pieces. Maybe you have the full playset of Stony Silence or something.
That seems aggressive.
I agree that's aggressive, but that is something that this format allows you to do, right? Where sure. you can kind of, you know, overboard for some decks that you really want to beat. And then in the matchups where you just are not prepared, like say you decide to skimp on Graveyard Hate, right? Sure. In a team event, if you get paired against Dredge and you have no Graveyard Hate in your sideboard, just at like a single person event, you're not winning and that's a loss. Like you're just done. But you could still play against Dredge in this team event and then get crushed because you have no Graveyard Hate and then have your two teammates win. Which I wouldn't count on, but is still a better scenario than in, you know, like a single person Modern event. So I'm not going to tell you to, you know, just completely metagame for one deck or go way overboard, but I would suggest toying with your sideboard a little bit, going a little heavier on what you expect to see. You know, maybe making a call like you're not going to see Tron, you don't need any, you know, land hate, maybe no Stone Rains or Crumble to Dust or whatever you were going to play. Maybe you make the call that you're not going to see, you know, Graveyard or Artifacts. Maybe you don't think you're going to see Affinity. I don't know.
You would be completely wrong in that scenario. That is a bad example.
I would agree with you that you're probably wrong to not play Affinity, but I think it's a risk that could pay off if you didn't get paired against Affinity, right?
Sure.
I mean, it's unlikely, but like if you make the call, like, oh, I'm just going to play no Artifact Hate whatsoever, and then you don't get paired against Affinity in the event, that's probably great for you. It's kind of like you just got to play a 17-card sideboard from what you normally would play, right?
Sure.
Again, I wouldn't suggest that one specifically, but
yeah,
the concept applies, right?
Right. All right. So let's bring it back around to sequencing. To that end, I wanted to cover some tech and some sideboard stuff that is going to sort of specifically attack a lot of these decks. And some of them are cards that don't normally see a lot of play, but also some of them are, you know, just sort of oldies but goodies that people have forgotten about.
Well, I think that's actually a great point, Aaron, is that some of these cards don't see play, but it's not because that they shouldn't see play, it's that people have forgotten about them. And, you know, these cards don't see play now until you put them in your sideboard and you crush somebody with them, and then, you know, next week these cards might be seeing play.
Yeah, that's true. The first one for me always, and I know I harp on this, but Torpor Orb, especially now, is I think at least worth one slot, maybe two. I play two right now because the decks that I've been playing have a lot of trouble with like humans and like Eldrazi taxes. So, and also Snapcasters. So it kind of like, it helps all of those things. And then also Jund versus Abzan is tough because they're one Lingering Souls. Obviously Torpor doesn't help against Lingering Souls, but you know, getting Siege Rhinode is really tough. They have a lot of like just value. And like, obviously if you are playing a Jund style deck, you want to minimize your opponent's value as much as you can. And Torpor Orb is really great at doing that.
Dude, I think Torpor Orb's a phenomenal call. And I think people forgot about it because of Splinter Twin being banned. I mean, its original kind of use in the format was turning off Deceiver Exarch, right?
Right.
But it's great against humans. You mentioned that. And just in general, two of the most top three most played creatures in Modern, Snapcaster Mage and Thoughtknot Seer, card is phenomenal against.
Yeah. And does not get blown up by, like, Ugin or, you know, that sort of thing that would often sort of mess you up. So
all is dust, even, yeah.
Protection all is from dust. It. That's what I was thinking of.
Immune to Rexage, too, in the Coco decks.
Indeed. That is definitely, like, a plus, because a lot of the creature-based decks will bring in Rexage or something like that. And, you know, a 3-mana 2/1 that doesn't do anything, not great. It's not a great Coco hit. I don't think you can overstate how completely it bones the humans deck. Torpor Orb on 2 means that you win the game straight up, because other than that, they're playing 1-mana 1/1s and 2-mana 2/1s. And that's pretty much it. Like, they'll still have Thalia. Yeah. Eldrazi Taxes, the black-white Eldrazi Taxes deck, we had sort of talked about this before we started recording, that deck is really good. And it has stuff in it that is just completely insane. And one of those things is, like, Flicker Wisp, Eldrazi Displacer, like, the... like Blade Splicer, their whole thing, Torpor Orb shuts that off. Like, if they have Eldrazi Displacer and Flicker Wisp, do yourself a favor, shut it down. Concede the game, because it is almost impossible that you will win. And it's just, oh, it's so obnoxious. It tilts me so hard. That said, the reason that it tilts me so hard is because it is unbelievably powerful and feels very unfair, because it kind of is. Like, they can blink your lands and the lands don't come back. It's just, ugh, what a mess.
It's pretty obnoxious. I agree.
It's super obnoxious. So Torpor Orb against them is great.
I mean, they're playing Eldrazi Displacer. Like, the entire point of their deck is to abuse ETB effects, right?
Correct.
They just want to do it over and over again. So let's turn them all off.
Yeah. So grab some Torpor Orbs.
Just want to point out Tokatl Honor Guard from the new set. 2-mana 1/3 Torpor Orb on a stick.
Yes.
People forgot about him, but he's a thing.
Yep. Torpor Orb also doesn't die to Fatal Push.
Yep. Well, that's true, too.
Throwing it out there. The next one I wanted to hit is Pithing Needle and Sorcerer's Spyglass. I recently had the misfortune of playing against Lantern on Magic Online, and I beat them, but it was not for want of them trying, and Sorcerer's Spyglass was a huge part of that, because knowing what you're naming, especially if you're not maybe as familiar with, like, every Bizarro deck or even all the top decks. I mean, you know, we talked about this sort of projected metagame. I mean, there's still, like, what, 11 decks on there or something like that. I mean, it's a lot to sort of know the main board and the sideboard plan for all of these decks. So Sorcerer's Spyglass sort of gives you a little bit of a leg up in terms of information, because you do get to see their hand, and then you can name, you know, some piece, whatever's in there. And obviously Pithing Needle is the same thing. Affinity, Arcbound Ravager, Cranial Plating, Ink Moth Nexus, Planeswalkers, any Planeswalker, Fetchlands, Steve's in Scapeshift. Like, I don't think I would bring it in against Scapeshift, but
I have brought in Pithing Needle against Scapeshift and Eldrazi Tron. And you are happy to do it, because a lot of your deck doesn't do anything in that matchup, and it does something.
It does something, right? It is not a blank piece of paper.
Well, there's like also stuff
to do a card sleeve.
There's also Colony Heart Expedition, which is also a thing.
Okay, sure.
I mean, not all of them play it, but you know,
you might get lucky.
Sure.
But it's a good catch all, or catch most, And like I said, if you can, if your opponent is on some kind of control deck, like some blue-white X control deck, and they go turn one, tap land, and then you go turn two, spyglass, you know, see what's in their hand, and go, okay, bam, spyglass naming Flooded Strand, you might be able to choke them out on mana while you
do something else. Does spyglass name lands? I thought it didn't name lands.
I thought it was any... Let me see.
So if it names lands, that's gross.
Then choose any card name.
Jeez, okay. Yeah. That's gross.
Yep. So it's two mana instead of one. You really need a combination of like encyclopedic format knowledge and luck to sort of like blind pithing needle somebody on turn one. So I don't see the two mana as a huge detriment. And like I said, the upside is there. So I'm on the Sorcerer's Spyglass train.
Yeah, I would generally, for most listeners, I would be with you on Sorcerer's Spyglass. I think just a quick little thing you can do is just like just pick five decks at random and think of the card that you would pithing needle against them. And if you don't like snap have the answer to all five, then you should probably Sorcerer's Spyglass.
There you go. A good internal test. Do I know enough to be able to make this weird call? And the answer for most people is probably no. Like, I mean, I probably could, but I spend 99% of my Magic time playing and researching Modern, so I don't know if that's a great, like, yardstick for people.
Well, no, it's not. But even, like, even to you, Sorcerer's Spyglass has value in the sense that you can't be wrong with Spyglass, right? Like,
yeah,
you could have a pithing needle, and I've done this, man, where I feel like I have a very good grasp of what I would pithing needle in any matchup. I had two pithing needles in my sideboard of Eldrazi Tron. I know against Affinity that I need to name specifically either Cranial Plating or Steel Overseer, and it's just a toss-up for me. So it's like, I just play my pithing needle on one, and if I hit the one that they have in their hand, I'm probably going to win the game, and if I don't hit the one they have in their hand, I'm going to lose. And, you know, I'll name Steel Overseer because I'm scared of that, and they play the turn two plating and kill me with it.
Yep.
And it's just like, you know, if this was a Sorcerer's Spyglass, I would have known ahead of time.
There you go. Burn your pithing needles. Invest in spyglasses. No, not really. Like, pithing needle is still good. Like, actually, even one and one would probably be okay, because then you makes it much harder to get Meddling Mage.
Absolutely.
Which is a thing again. Anti-search. I put Shadow of Doubt in here. There are a couple of other anti-search effects, like Arbiter. Leonin Arbiter is obviously probably like the most powerful one, but it's also very narrow. Like, it's hard to play Leonin Arbiter in a non-Death and Taxes shell, because most decks aren't built around that, or most decks have a search component. But Shadow of Doubt.
Even Mind Sensor.
Sure.
That was just opponents.
Yep. So Shadow of Doubt, Even Mind Sensor.
There is a colorless one. There's a colorless one from, I want to say, Mirrodin, that does 2 damage to someone every time they shuffle their library.
Oh.
That one's not as good, but it is a hate card.
That's not Mind Crank. What is it? Oh, it's Psychogenic Probe.
That's what it's called. Yep.
What did I forget to have that piece of knowledge in my brain? I'm like, oh god, why do I know that? Like, and I know that the reason that I know that is because I almost certainly at some point was like, I need to try and make a Psychogenic Probe combo deck. And also, for anyone who's curious, there actually is one. And it's real bad.
I would believe that it's real bad.
Yeah. So, anyways, anti-search, Shadow of Doubt, Aven Mind Sensor. It is great for Scapeshift, obviously. It turns off Scapeshift itself. It'll get just either just the ETB trigger or just the attack trigger of a Primeval Titan. So I don't know that I would rely on it in that matchup, but it is very useful. And it cantrips, so like that's it's a very low cost card to play. So if you're in blue or black, or preferably blue and black, because it makes it much easier to cast. I'm pretty on Shadow of Doubt if you're in a white build where you just kind of want another effect like that. Mind Sensor is great. Also, shutting off Gifts in Storm is very good, because they will tap out to play Gifts, no problem. Like, they're not going to be playing around Shadow of Doubt. And they don't play Spell Pierce, to my knowledge. I think they're just on Remand right now. So if they don't have a bear in play and they just go slam my fourth land, Gifts, and you go Shadow of Doubt, that's a huge hit for them.
Also, a very common play in Storm is the turn three, end of opponent's turn, Ritual Gifts to try and go off on your turn four. That's pretty gross. If they go Ritual Gifts and you go counter draw for two mana, still get to hold up mana.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. It's like a two mana Cryptic Command.
Yep.
The next one, and this is one that I toyed around with this slot because I had been thinking about Red Green Tron and like how they used to run four main deck Pyroclasms because they would just get run over all the time. And then the metagame sort of shifted. But now that there are a density of small creature decks, having access to a Pyroclasm-esque effect is, I think, more important than it has been in recent memory. I put Kozilek's Return in there because I think of the main ones that would see play, it is probably the best, and that is mainly because it is instant speed. It has extra upside because it will kill an Etch Champion, which Pyroclasm and Anchor the Gods and Sweltering Suns will not. That said, any of those would also be good choices. Pyroclasm is great because it's two mana. Anger of the Gods is great because it's three damage instead of two damage, and it exiles. So there's like a splash damage element there. Sweltering Suns is great. Three damage and it cycles. Radiant Flames is also very good. I've played a number of decks where I want to be able to sometimes like cast Radiant Flames for two because I just need to kill my opponent's little stuff and not kill my X3s. Or, you know, if I'm playing bigger stuff that's higher up on the curve, I can just play Radiant Flames for three and not have to worry about my stuff getting exiled if it gets killed, you know,
yep,
after I play it. So sort of find a home for some kind of sweeper.
I really like Kozilek's Return right now.
I do too. I think it's the best. I think the instant speed really pushes it over the top for me.
Well, I mean, like one point, yeah, like it is the instant speed, and it's because, you know, a lot of talk in Modern is about how Celestial Colony is the best man land, but it is not the best man land. The best man land by leaps and bounds above all other man lands is Inkwoth Nexus. And that is one you would like to kill with your sweeper if you can.
Raging Ravine?
No, I think Inkwoth Nexus is just way better than all the other man lands. It's close. Mutavault, I think, is the next best, and then it's like Raging Ravine and Colonnade. But
okay.
Inkwoth Nexus is outrageous, man. It's like, it's Legacy playable, and it's like good in Legacy.
Sure. Raging Ravine is also Legacy playable, by the way. Just throw
it. I mean, that's fair, but like Infect has won events in Legacy. Like, it wins Legacy GPs.
That's true.
Because yep. It's because of how hard it is to deal with an Inkwoth Nexus.
Yes. Agreed. All right, so Inkwoth Nexus is great. Killing it with Kozilek's Return is also great.
Yep. It's nice, too, that it'll hit, like, the Noble Hierarch, too. You just get that splash, like, gotcha effect.
Yeah. the other thing, too, right? Infect is back, and being able to respond to a pump spell with a sweeper is insanely backbreaking for them.
Oh, yes.
So, because it means they need to have, like, something plus mutagenic growth in order for their thing to survive. And that is not always the case. So, it is very versatile, and I care for it a great deal. The next one is, Eidolon of Rhetoric, and there's a bunch of these type of effects, where either players can only cast one spell per turn, or stuff like Defense Grid does a similar thing where it's not exactly analogous, but Defense Grid makes spells cost 3 colorless more if you are trying to cast it and it's not your turn. Basically, the Oracle text is more clear, but that's basically what it is. It's great against, like, counterspell decks and burn decks because it makes everything their sorcery speed because they can't afford to pay 4 mana for anything. So, like, getting Skullcracked, you wouldn't play Skullcrack if it cost 5 mana.
I concur, you would not play that card.
Yeah, that is not a card. I mean, like, Flames of the Bloodhand was a stretch at 3. And that does not see play anymore. So Eidolon of Rhetoric, there's also Rule of Law, which I like very much. Which is same text, just on an enchantment. It is double white, though.
Rule of Law is single white.
Is it?
I think it's the exact same casting cost as Eidolon of Rhetoric.
Let's find out.
I'm pretty sure Eidolon of Rhetoric is the exact same card, just on a 1/4. Just literally has 1/4 at the bottom.
Huh. Ain't that about to be? What am I thinking? Oh, I'm thinking of Aura of Silence.
Sure.
Which I don't know if that's modern legal. But it is a very good card. Oh, yeah, it was in 10th edition. There you go. Aura of Silence is a very good card. 1 white for an enchantment. Artifact and enchantment spells. Target opponent. Oh, cost target opponent. Oh, this is the old. This is the Weatherlight. Text is very awkward. I'm sorry. Aura of Silence, 1 white, artifact and enchantment spells your opponents cast cost 2 generic more to cast, and you can sack Aura of Silence instant speed to destroy an artifact or enchantment. Great. Highly recommend. So just another taxing effect that does not die to removal.
Well, I think I actually like Rule of Law better than Eidolon of Rhetoric right now, just because Storm decks have moved to playing Dismember, and Dismember is very good in their deck because it literally just is 4 life. Like, they don't even have to pay the colorless.
Yep.
A lot of times.
Yeah. No, I am a huge fan of Rule of Law. Plus, it's Sweetheart, and it has 2 printings. It's very inexpensive, but very impactful. A resolved Rule of Law means that they cannot win the game through their original plan. They can try and beat you down with 2 goblin tokens and a brawl. That's not a good plan.
Not a great plan.
it is also, like, it is good splash damage against burn. They really want to be casting more than 1 spell per turn, and taking their clock from, like, 4 turns to 7 turns is not, like, they are not designed for the long game. So if you stretch it out and you've got a better, like, mid or end game than them, it's lights out. Also, who knows, maybe somebody shows up with Living End and you can't Living End through a Rule of Law because your Cascade counts as your spell, and then Living End just doesn't happen.
Also, it's great against Snapcaster decks. I think people forget that.
Yeah, yep. it is good, because, man, that Snapcaster.
I mean, if you want to make Snapcaster into a 2-mana 2-1, that's probably a win for you.
Yes, agreed. The next one I wanted to cover is Meddling Mage. Obviously is back, but Meddling Mage, Nevermore type effects. And also I lumped Ruined Halo effects in with that. Ruined Halo is a white-white enchantment that gives you protection from a card. The nice thing is it's not, it can be any card. So, like, you can Ruined Halo, name Valakut, and not die to Scapeshift. I mean, you'll still die to Primetime, but you can't get comboed out. Or, you know, you can Ruined Halo, name whatever, Death Shadow, or...
It's good against Death Shadow. I've seen people name Reality Smasher with it and be successful.
Yeah, Reality Smasher is a real hard card to deal with.
You can name Grapeshot against Storm. That's generally not terrible.
That's a good turn two play.
I will warn people, though, that you cannot name tokens with Ruined Halo. So if you bring anything against Storm and you think they're on the Empty the Warrens plane, you cannot name Goblin Token, because that does not work.
Oh, because it doesn't actually have a name?
Yep.
Huh.
Well, it has to be a card, too, because tokens are not cards. It says name a card.
Huh. Today I learned.
Yep.
But there's, like I said, there's a lot of these. Of the ones that are available, most of them are white somehow. There's also Oketra's something or other does the same thing. Obviously from Amonkhet. I don't remember the name of it is, but I think it's 3-mana, and I would probably play Ruined Halo before I played that card. But those type of effects are quite good. They're very strong, and Ruined Halo used to see a lot more play early on, fell out of favor, started to come back. I think it's in a good spot right now. The last one that I wanted to cover is Hallowed Moonlight. Hallowed Moonlight is, 1 and a white. Instant, if a creature would enter the battlefield and it wasn't cast, exile it instead, and you draw a card. Coco, Breach, Aether Vial,
Court of Calling.
Court of Calling.
Everything in the Dredge deck. Living End.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Dredge. It just has a lot of, like, relevant things that, and in the same way as, like, Shadow of Doubt, is very low risk to play. Like, if you think somebody's going to, whatever, Breach Titan, Summoner's Pact,
It doesn't really work against Summoner's Pact.
Doesn't Summoner's Pact put it on the battlefield?
No. The card would be way busted if it put it on the battlefield.
What am I thinking of?
Summoning Trap. You're thinking of Summoning Trap.
Oh, okay. Nobody plays Summoning Trap.
That's not true. I got Summoning Trapped at the last SCG I played in. And it was, like, it would have been game-winning. I countered a guy's Primeval Titan. He cast Summoning Trap after I countered it. I freaked out because I knew I was dead to Primeval Titan. And then he looks at his top 7 cards and goes... Ugh. Puts his head down and puts the Sakura Tribalder in play.
Oh, sick beats.
Oh, I'm so lucky. So lucky.
I actually really like Summoning Trap, personally, but...
It's a really strong card against blue decks.
Yep. So there's just a ton of stuff. Not Summoner's Pact. But yeah, anything puts something on the battlefield, Goryeo's Vengeance, some smart aleck is going to show up. Nahiri's Ultimate.
These things exist.
Yeah, these things are real and often are designed to be the end game, where, like, the person has put in a lot of resources, and then they're like, okay, white deck, I know you don't have a counterspell for my Through the Breach, so Breach Emrakul, I win. And you just go, boop, Hollowed Moonlight, you lose.
Well, that's actually a great point, Aaron, is that one, like, I think this is actually one of the best, like, low-key sideboard card that you've mentioned in this entire segment, just because, one, it's so low cost. It's like Shadow of Doubt in that, you know, worst-case scenario, it's 2-mana draw card, which, you know, you wouldn't play that card, but as a worst-case scenario, like, it's pretty good, right?
Yep.
But it has the huge upside of nobody plays it, so nobody plays around it ever.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be like playing around like Lapse of Certainty or some, you know, like Rebuff the Wicked or some weird like white counterspell, of which, like I said, I think there are probably four that I can think of, like Dawn Charm,
Manatithe. Rebuff.
Oh, Manatithe. The reality of playing a deck that is built to take advantage of Manatithe and the actual, like, real reality of playing Manatithe is you always remember when you got them, and you tend to forget the times when it was just a complete trash pile that you should not have registered in your deck. And I love that card. It's bad. Like, it just...
It's not great.
It's really, like... Force Spike, turns out, is not good enough. It's not even good enough in formats where the original Force Spike is legal. So, you know, like, we have Spell Pierce. We have... Like,
oh, but if you make that Force Spike cost zero, it's one of the most played cards in the format.
True.
It's a very different card.
It is a very different card.
Just return that island to your hand.
Sure. Yeah. Ugh, days. This card is so obnoxious. Like, and also, similarly, like, arguably a very medium card that people play because the times that it is good, it's great, and the times that it's, like, just complete trash, people are just like, eh, well, someday it'll be great. And sometimes it is. Same thing with Manatithe. But anywho, play Hallowed Moonlight. The card's really great.
I think you could do worse than putting it in the sideboard of white decks. Like that.
Definitely.
That card comes out of nowhere against people. I mean, if you're playing like Abzan midrange, Coco is like not a great matchup for you. Neither is, I guess, Through the Breach is probably okay for you, but it's not like great by any means. Like, they could definitely assemble it. And nobody is expecting a counterspell out of these decks. Like, nobody's going to play around this ever. Like, if you're playing Boggles and you want to put a Hallowed Moonlight in your sideboard to, you know, stop a... it's not great against Aether Vial, sadly. I wish it was better against Aether Vial, but they can just, like, not put the creature in play.
Sure. Well, once they activate it, don't they have to?
No, they don't. Because you can activate your Aether Vial with no cards in hand.
Oh, you may put a creature. Yeah. Womp.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's not great against Aether Vial, but maybe it is, like, maybe it's, like, it buys you that turn. Maybe they were going to activate it here, and it, like, prevents a blowout from happening, where they were going to Vial in a Flicker Wish to counter or something, or whatever. And you don't even have to feel bad about casting it, because you get to draw your card back, you know? So, I think that's, you know, I think that's a card that should see more play in Modern than it currently is seeing, which is zero.
Yes, agreed. I've also been on a roll. I can't remember. I'm sure I mentioned this last time, but I'm going to mention it again because there's an event coming up.
I just thought of a sweet combo.
Lay it on me. I'm ready.
If you Flicker Wisp out somebody's thing and then Hallowed Moonlight, the thing just stays exiled. That's awesome. They're both white. It's perfect.
A 5-mana path to exile.
I mean, like, maybe you have your own Aether Vial. Maybe you, like, Vial it in and then cast your Hallowed Moonlight.
That would hit your thing, too.
Well, no, because the end of turn, so you just, like, blink their thing out and then you cast it. I mean, it's a reach, but it's not zero. Like, it's just, like, another, like, if you put it in your Death and Taxes deck, like, you could for sure bring this card in and maybe get some value out of it, you know?
Yes. You could definitely, like, get somebody's Emrakul with that, which you would not normally be able to do. Which I guess is a thing.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know. No, it's fine.
Plus think of the beat story equity you get.
It's, yeah, I mean, that's high, but also I feel like winning is better in that scenario.
Generally, but you're never going to forget that time you got him with the Hail of Moonlight.
I understand. No, trust me. I remember every single time I ever shanked somebody with a mana tithe got him with whatever. But I also unlike many people that just insist on playing gotcha decks, also remember the times when it just completely failed, and that tempers my desire to continue to play suboptimal things.
Sure.
When I'm playing competitively, I do obviously spend a lot of time playing more for fun, and I will definitely cop to playing terrible decks, lots of terrible decks, and doing brews and stuff like that where, you know, the overall strategy and card quality is sometimes questionable. And I do definitely remember the times when I got somebody with a brew more than the times when that I failed to get someone with a brew.
Fair.
So the other sort of tech or general, I guess sort of state of the format thing is I would really encourage people to diversify their, not only diversify their removal, but also diversify the CMC of their creature base. If you play a deck that is 100% just free roll kills with Fatal Push, you're going to have a hard time because a lot of people are still on for Fatal Push, even though arguably that is incorrect. Because right when it's great. Cause you're oh, it's super Disfigure, and Disfigure used to see real play. And sometimes it is super Disfigure, and sometimes it's, I don't have a fetch land, and this person has a Knight of the Reliquary that I literally have no way of killing, and I'm going to die because of it. So two Fatal Push max in the main, play a Dismember. You will not be sorry that you have a Dismember instead of a third Fatal Push. I promise.
Well, I wouldn't say two is the max, but I would not play four. I'm with you. I think you can play three, three and one. I think that's okay, that's sure. Fine, but yeah. No, I mean, you're totally right on the main point here of don't just slam a four of for just because you think it's, you know, the best one, right? Like,
bam. And also, right, so as the format widens, it's not like 3 CMC is now what it used to be. 3 CMC used to basically just be the cap, where Abrupt Decay killed everything, Inquisition of Kozilek got everything out of somebody's hand, except for Tron. And, you know, people wouldn't even think, the only 4-drop that you would play is Splinter Twin, because, you know, why are you going to spend 4 mana on something? That's stupid. Now, where even mid-range decks like Jund, like Abzan, have tools and cards that are good enough that, Jund is now playing Rabble Master. Rabble Master is not a Fatal Push free roll. They have to put work in order to kill your Rabble Master. They have to put work in to kill your, even something that does see a lot of play anyway, Kitchen Finks. Their stock, in my mind, has gone way up because it's it's path, or their Fatal Push becomes also, I have to crack a fetch land, take a point of damage minimum to kill your Kitchen Finks, which is just going to come back.
Yep. Well, I think you're totally right on this. I will say the one removal spell I think you just still are playing a four of, and that's not changing, is Path.
Oh, yeah.
I think Path is just so far and away better than every other removal spell in the format right now that You just play four.
Agreed. Yep. But I really like I've been playing two Fatal Push, a Dismember, and like a Go for the Throat has been good. Depending on the deck, I'll play Murderous Cut sometimes. You know, 2-2 Fatal Push Dismember, 3-1 Fatal Push Dismember is good. Hero's Downfall is great. Dreadbore, Terminate, like if you are playing Terminate, you have access to Fatal Push. 2 Fatal Push, 3 Terminate is a very nice spread. It is a good place to be because you don't have to waste your Terminates on Noble Hierarchs, and you can still kill a Gurmag Angler.
Yep.
So that's my mini diatribe and my sort of tech and sideboarding piece. So if you want to go, if you want to talk about your segment on sequencing, that would be, this is the time.
First, I'm going to give you a general definition of what is sequencing. I mean, sequencing is literally just how you play your cards, right? It's just the order in which you cast spells and, you know, the time in between. Like maybe you cast a spell on one and then you don't cast something on two. And you cast something on three and that was the sequence you chose, right? So to sequence correctly, there are two things you have to be aware of at all times. The first is your own game plan, right? You need to know what you are trying to accomplish with your deck and what accomplishing that looks like, right? So maybe you're a burn deck and your goal is to get your opponent to zero life. And for you in your deck, that looks like, you know, having a Goblin Guy hit them 10 times, or, you know, you resolve 6 Lightning Bolt / Lava Spike / whatever effects. Now, that's not like the end-all be-all, but you have to remember that's what this looks like. Maybe in Lantern, the sequence is, you know, you have a bridge in play, you have a Lantern in play, and a mill piece, and they just draw a land every turn for the rest of the game. But to correctly sequence your cards, knowing your own game plan is not enough, right? You have to know your opponent's game plan. You have to know what a win for them looks like and how they intend to interact with your game plan and vice versa. Now, that's not always going to be a slam dunk. Now, you won't always know what your opponent's trying to do, and you won't always, you know, sequence perfectly against them, but that's part of playing, that's part of learning, right? Is that to correctly sequence, you have to match up what your game plan is versus what theirs is, and what both are trying to accomplish, and figure out the correct order in which to cast things to make your game plan succeed and theirs fail, right? Now, that sounds complicated, and I guess it kind of is, but what we can do is give you some, I guess, more hard examples to make it a little bit more clear. So, for example, let's say you are playing Death and Taxes against Storm. Well, the Storm deck's goal is to kill you with a Grape Shot or a Very Large Empty the Warrens. And they're going to achieve this by casting a lot of spells. Now, to do that, they need to generate a lot of mana, get a lot of cards, and, you know, to cast a lot of spells, you need to draw cards and make mana to cast the spells. So, generally, they're going to accomplish this with Pass and Flames. But, as it happens in the deck, they will play a card, like Gifts Ungiven, to, you know, find their Pass and Flames and draw them more cards. Well, in your Taxes deck, Leonin Arbiter just happens to be very good against Gifts Ungiven, happens to be very good against the fetch lands they play, so it is a card they do not want on the battlefield. But, even more important is Thalia. Thalia just makes all this stuff cost one more, which, you know, essentially counters multiple rituals and just kind of makes it impossible for them to storm off. Well, if you know that your Storm opponent has a Lightning Bolt in hand, the correct way to sequence is going to be play your Leonin so that they are forced to deal with it, so that they Lightning Bolt it, so that they can cast their Gifts Ungiven, and then you play your Thalia to stop them from going off. Now, that's a pretty basic example of how you would go about sequencing it, but that applies in a lot of situations, and people don't really think about that as much, I guess. You know, this happens in Jund, too, where it's like, you know, if you're playing against a deck that has removal spell, say, the Jund Mirror. Well, in the Jund Mirror, having a Tarmogoyf out is great, you know. Tarmogoyf is probably going to win the game if it gets left unchecked, but the whole deck is full of removal spells, and it's very easy to kill a Tarmogoyf in the Mirror. But, you know, if you leave, even for one turn, a Bob out to draw an extra card, well, the Dark Confidant is going to draw, you know, enough cards to put you over the top, generally, in the matchup. So, it's generally better against these removal-heavy decks to play your Tarmogoyf first, so that they kill it, and then you can play your Bob the next turn, and then maybe it'll live. So that's an example of sequencing two drops. It seems minor, but these are the types of things you need to think about when you have multiple two drops in your hand, or when you have like a two drop and a three drop that kind of do similar things. You need to think this through, and it's not always right to just strictly curve out. Even though curving out is generally good in Magic, it's not always right to just go two drop, three drop, four drop, because, you know, this is Modern where very powerful things happen. Maybe it's better to go no two drop, three drop, two drop, and then four drop, because that plays around what your opponent is going to do more often, right? You know, some other minor examples of sequencing are, you know, something that comes up very often is Monastery Swift Spear, right? It's a card burn plays a lot, and it has a mechanic called Prowess on it. Now, in Prowess asks you to cast your spell before combat, generally, so that your creature will get +1/+1, so it'll do more damage when it attacks, right? And, you know, in a very generic scenario, it is just better for you to sequence all of your spells you're going to cast that turn before combat so that you get more damage on your Swift Spear. Now, you can play games with this, right? You can have your Swift Spear in play, and if you think your opponent has a counter spell or a kill spell for your Swift Spear even, maybe you don't cast your spells in your main phase because, you know, they're going to kill it anyway. Or maybe you convince them that they can do something else end of turn because you didn't have spells to cast. Maybe you only have, like, one spell to cast in your hand. Maybe you just, like, have one card in hand. And they think, well, you know, if he had the spell, he would have cast it main phase to get the Prowess trigger. And then you go to your end of turn, and, you know, they're like, well, all right, maybe I can just run out this spell queller I was going to hold up. That was, like, the last card in their hand or whatever. Or maybe they have more cards, but maybe you just only have one. They're like, I'm going to run out my spell queller. Well, now they're tapped down, and you can resolve the Boros Charm you're holding or the Skullcrack or whatever it is. So,
yep.
Yeah, taking advantage of things on the board, information available to both players, is very important. And that's kind of what the Prowess example of is getting at, is that when information is known by both players are taking it into their game plan. So sequencing around that information being known is very important. And that seems obvious. That seems like something you would think of. And most players do, but it's like the fallacy here, the thing that people miss is that, you know, your opponent is also taking it into effect. So that changes the way you're supposed to sequence it, I guess. So just some general rules. You know, sequence to take advantage of known information on both players. You generally want to sequence to hurt your opponent's reactive spells, right? Like I said with the two drops, you play your spells out to make their reactive spells worse. And then the third one I came up with that is, I guess, thought of as less important than the first two, with taking advantage of known information and sequencing to hurt your opponent's reaction, is sequence to make your interaction better. Now, this doesn't seem, I don't know, this doesn't seem that intuitive to people, because a lot of people will think, well, you're just going to play your interaction whenever it's best, right? It's not really how you sequence it, but there are tricks to making your interaction better if sequenced properly. Like, for example, something a lot of Jund players will do, you know, is if their opponent has one card in hand, and their opponent's been holding it, and you draw your Thoughtseize, well, they're just going to cast that Thoughtseize because, you know, this Thoughtseize isn't getting better. It's just going to rot in your hand, generally, because your opponent's going to play their spells, and you're going to play your spells, and you're never really going to have a target with it. So maybe you're going to get that last card in their hand. But good players will wait until they've drawn a threat they want to protect with their Thoughtseize. You know, they will sit there, hold that Thoughtseize in their own hand, and then, you know, maybe they draw their Dark Confidant, and, well, all right, maybe now I can Thoughtseize, and, you know, maybe your opponent was holding on to a Lightning Bolt because they knew that Dark Confidant was going to be really good for you. And you get to take that out of their hand before you play your Bob and, you know, let that carry you to a win. And I think people don't do that enough, and I think it's something they need to do more often, is think about how to time, you know, their hand disruption better, I guess. You know, generally, turn one Thoughtseize, turn two Tarmogoyf is great. But if that's great, so is turn three Thoughtseize into Tarmogoyf, right? So,
turn one Thoughtseize into turn two Tarmogoyf is great if it's turn one Thoughtseize, take your Fatal Push, and you don't have any other removal spells.
Sure.
So, obviously, I play a lot of discard, just generally speaking.
Sure.
I will, especially nowadays, it used to be always correct to lead on Inquisition. Now, I will often lead on Thoughtseize because I don't necessarily always need to take your turn one play, because the idea previously, like that, the Jun curve out of like turn one Disruption, turn two Dark Confidant, turn three Liliana, like win the game. I'm less concerned now about like taking your whatever Land of War Elf or your Noble Hierarch, probably. I want to be able to take anything in your hand, because chances are the thing that's going to kill me is 4 mana or more, at least like a non-zero number of the times. And if all you have going is, like, I played against Infect today, so I'll use this as an example. I had in my hand two removal spells and a Thoughtseize. So I Thoughtseize them. I took their Become Immense because it was the only thing that I was going to lose to. And then they played their, you know, Glistener Elf. And I was like, okay, terminate your Glistener Elf. And then the next turn, they didn't have a Blossoming Defense, or at least they would have had to, at that point, they would have had to draw Blossoming Defense to save their second Infect creature. So I already knew they didn't have anything that could kill me. I had answers to everything, and their only out is like a three of in their deck. I don't think they play four Blossoming Defense. They might, but even so, even if it's a four outer and, you know, in the early turns of the game, it's whatever, they're one out of 40 something to draw the exact single card that saves their creature. Like, I guess that or Vines would have done it. But having the ability to take anything is more important than just like stumbling you, which previously was not the case. The other thing that I think is important that people sort of miss with discard and those type of effects is you always take the thing that you can't deal with, and take the thing that is the most problematic, even if they can't cast it right now, unless they're just like totally jammed up. I mean, obviously it's a judgment call. If they get a handful of five drops and one land, okay, sure. Like, take the Snapcaster, because you always take the Snapcaster. If they have like two lands and a Geist, you take the Geist. Or you take the Supreme Verdict, or you take the, you know, take the thing that you lose to, and use that information to sort of guide your next, maybe your next discard spell. So maybe you lead on Thoughtseize, and then the next turn you Inquisition, see what they drew, and then either play your Bob or play your Tarmogoyf. And sometimes, like, you're just doing that to bait out a removal spell. You're like, both of these are must answer, but maybe I put the Bob out there because I'm like, okay, he is going to eat the Fatal Push, and then I'm going to untap and go two drop. You know, I'll play another Bob and a Tarmogoyf, and life's great.
Sure. Well, I think, too, the lead on Thoughtseize is more prevalent now because you have Fatal Push, right? Where Fatal Push is kind of set up to kill one and two drop things. So, you know, you're happier to take their four drop and then, you know, next turn you can Fatal Push their play that you weren't going to take with the Thoughtseize anyway. It's just a minor thing, but it goes to your point of sequencing around the things that you can deal with, right?
Yeah.
And then the other point I wanted to hit on with sequencing is, you know, still to make your own interaction better, in blue decks, sequencing with counterspells is very important. We don't have the luxury in Modern of having cards like Force of Will or Daze, where it doesn't really matter how you sequence those cards, they're just going to be good. That's kind of...
Disrupting Shoal.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we have Disrupting Shoal, but that one even is kind of in this because you have to, you know, exile the right casting cost, which makes it very hard and actually very important to sequence correctly so that you have the right casting cost card in your hand, right?
Yes.
But past that, you want to sequence blue spells to best take advantage of their tempo aspect, right? You want, generally, if you're casting a 2-mana counterspell, you want to counter something that costs 4, or, you know, if you're casting a 1-mana counterspell, you want to counter something that costs 3, or whatever.
You want to trade up when possible.
You always want to trade up, right? But you also want to trade it with cards that matter. Like, if you're losing on board and you trade your 1-mana counterspell with their 3-mana thing that doesn't matter, well, you didn't really do that much, I guess. So you have to kind of line up your counterspell with the right thing. And one of the best ways to do that in this format is to hold them. Hold on to your counterspell. A lot of times, you know, you're going to have that counter in your hand for their turn 2 play. Like in Jeskai, for example, you'll have a Logic Knot there and you'll have a Lightning Helix. And you'll have this option to... You know, you can either Logic Knot their turn 2 play, or you can Lightning Helix it, or Path it, or whatever. And generally, holding your counterspell means that you're going to have a better opportunity to counter a more expensive spell. But in addition to that, it's going to open up the amount of things that you can counter, right? Like, you get more opportunities for them to cast spells, so it lets you see more spells that you could, in theory, counter with the card. So delaying counters is generally better when sequencing them. And then delaying them to back up your other spells is even better. Where it's like, you know, you could have cast your Logic Knot on turn 2, or your Mana Leak, or Remand, or whatever it was on turn 2 to, you know, kind of buy you some time. But it's even better to, you know, cast your 3-drop on turn 5 and then hold up the counter spell. Because now, you know, you can either protect your spell if that's what matters, or you can counter their big play if that's what matters. And generally, a good rule of thumb is to wait on counterspells. And even more than that, and just kind of like a microcosm of a counterspell, you know, if you have like a counterspell or removal spell in your hand, and it's your opponent's first main phase, and they're like, all right, I'm going to go to attacks, and they attack with their guy. Well, you know, a newer player's general idea is, hey, let's kill the guy that's attacking me, so I, you know, save some life points. Well, you know, even people who've only been playing Control a little while know it's generally better to wait until the end of their turn to kill their guy. Take a little bit of damage so you can see if you want to counter their play. And that's just kind of how counterspells work in a microcosm, where it's just so much better in this format to hold them as long as you can. So that's kind of all we had for sequencing. Again, the most important thing is knowing what matters. And it's not always going to be possible to know what matters for your opponents exactly, but you can always know what matters for you. And it's very easy in this format to know, hey, my game plan is do this. Like, maybe it's Infect. I need to put 10 Infect counters on my opponent. How do I do this? I need to protect my creatures. I need to pump them up. So to sequence, you know, sequencing that, it is inexcusable not to know what your own deck is trying to do. You need to do that. If you want to be successful in Modern, you need to know what your own deck's trying to do. And then to become better at sequencing, the trick is to learn the format, right? Like, that's something that comes with time, that's something that comes with practice, that's something that comes with watching your opponents, and that's something even very good players mess up with, is not knowing exactly what their opponent was trying to do. They try to play around the wrong stuff, but you will get better with time as you're making these thought processes during games. You're like, well, hey, maybe before you were just, I'm going to play these cards. Well, now you're like, well, you know, maybe my opponent's trying to do this, or at least I think they're trying to do this. I may not even know, but I think they're trying to do this. Let's see if we can kind of alter what they're trying to do by changing the way we sequence our cards. And I think that is going to give you the best chance of getting better at sequencing. So yeah, I mean, you won't know right away. You won't be perfect at it, but thinking about it will make you better. And follow the rules, you know, sequence, take advantage of your cards, sequence, take advantage of known information on board, and sequence to try and make your opponent's cards worse.
Yeah, I mean, you want to, I guess part of it is you really want to try and dictate, to the extent that it matters for the deck that you're playing, you want to dictate the terms of the game, if that makes any sense.
Well, I think sequencing is right. Like, you're sequencing to take advantage of your cards. Like, you're taking the thing that this one hits, you're taking the thing that this one hits, so that you leave them with the thing that this one's going to hit, you know, with Wrench Mine's going to hit twice. So, right. It, you know, it's sequencing to take advantage of your cards, which I think is relevant, right? It's like a...
Yeah. Yep.
Place, but I don't know. So this is a very hard topic to talk about. I'm not going to lie.
It is. Well, it's... Yeah, I mean, it's... But it's important. And, it's very important. You know, part of it, I guess, is developing patience. And this is something that I struggle with, because a lot of the time, well, because I play a lot of like decks that play a lot of things at sorcery speed, I do have a habit of playing instant speed stuff, like just first main in my turn, which is very bad. Like that is a habit that I need to break. I actually had one of my friends say that. He was like, I was watching your stream and you were like abrupt decaying things in your main phase. And I'm like, yeah, well, I'm going to abrupt decay it anyways. Might as well do it now. And he's like, well, but what if they play something else that you need to abrupt decay?
Sure.
I'm like, they might play something else that I need to abrupt decay. Perhaps I should think about that. So I guess there's an element of, you know, play the cards that you have to play during your main phase, and then anything that you can play at instant speed, play it when it is most impactful, not when you're just like, oh, I'm just going to get this card out of my hand because I know I'm going to kill this thing, or I know I'm going to do this. Like, just wait.
Yeah, I mean...
Wait until you actually have to deal with it. Because who knows? Like, you could be staring at somebody's, like... whatever, Tarmogoyf, and you've got an abrupt decay in your hand, and you're just like, okay, well, I can kill it right now, or I can wait to see if they attack. Like, they may not even attack with it, so I don't need to kill it right now because it's not really an issue. And then they drop a Liliana, and you're like, I need to abrupt decay that because that is going to make me lose the game.
Yep. So I guess you hit on like a very good point there, actually, that I kind of missed was... You want a sequence to maximize information, which is kind of non-intuitive. Like, a lot of times in a lot of matchups, it's actually very valuable to trade life, like tangible resources, whether it be, you know, life points or cards even, for information. And you will do this a lot in Limited, where it's like, I'm trading cards to try and figure out if they have a combat trick or if they have a removal spell, you know? And that happens in Modern, just like you said. Like, you could cast your Abrupt Decay in your first main phase, or you could wait because, you know, Abrupt Decay can't be countered anyway, so there's very little downside. Well, you know, maybe they play something more important, just like you said. So sequencing to maximize information, also very, very important. And it's kind of what I hit on with the counterspells, where you know, the more you wait, the more opportunity you have to see things to counter. That's another example of sequencing to maximize information, but... It's, you know, a very important concept that, you know, often gets lost when trying to decide how to sequence.
Hmm. Yeah, it's a big topic, and it's, I'm sure, something that we can come back to, like, after the event, I think, because it'll happen. Will it happen before our next show?
It should.
Yeah. So when we come back, I think it'll be worthwhile to sort of touch on this again. So while you're down there, and I will attempt to do the same, you know, try and just be like, oh, this was an important sequence of play, and we will talk about them in the next episode.
Absolutely. Well, I know my important sequence is going to be play Geist on 3.
Yeah.
Third land Geist. That's good sequencing.
Yeah. Fair. Cavern naming spirit.
Oh, no. That's my nightmare.
Well, no, that's great for you.
Well, if it's your
if it's your cavern, yeah.
If it's a cavern naming anything on the other side, I'm terrified.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, because you have nothing. You don't play Ghost Quarter or anything, do you?
Oh, nope. I have Spellqueller. That's all I have.
I mean, it's good enough most of the time.
Well, cavern naming Eldrazi is the nightmare. You can't Spellqueller a Reality Smasher.
That also correct. So I'm going to, we're going to talk about sort of when to call a judge, and then, I'm going to call a judge, and have a discussion with them, which I'm going to sort of stitch in afterwards. But the short answer is always call a judge. There's literally no downside to calling a judge. They're there for a reason. And you also do not have to talk to the judge about your opponent in front of your opponent. You can just ask them, just say, I have a question. Can I ask you away from the table? And they will always, 100% of the time, they will say yes.
Yep.
And then you will get a time extension. You will get your question answered or whatever. Your concern will be addressed. And then you go back and play the game. So I think that people are often worried about like being perceived as a jerk if they call a judge. That is, you need to fight that instinct, because like the judges are there to help everybody. Including your opponent, you know, including you, obviously, but also like they're a resource that is there for everyone, and they are there specifically to help everyone. So,
well, even more than that, something that is becoming more and more a trend recently, I guess, is that judge calls have been changed to benefit the person calling the judge. It used to not always be in your favor to call a judge. Like, let's say, for example, it's game one of, like, the fifth round of a tournament, right? And you draw your opening hand, you have a sideboard card. Well, it's game one, you're not supposed to have a sideboard card. Previously, if you called a judge on yourself, you would get game loss, match loss. I think it's a game loss, so it would send you to game two, right? Well, now if you call the judge on yourself, it is just a penalty in the form of you de-sideboard and now you, like, draw a six. You're, like, essentially forced to take a mulligan, which... much better than a game loss, and in fact incentivizes you to call the judge. And they're trying to change more and more calls like this, where it's like, well, should I call a judge, should I not call a judge, to essentially reward you for calling the judge. So generally the rule of thumb now should be, could I call a judge in this situation? Is there any reason to call a judge? If you can come up with a reason why you should call a judge, that's, you know, a tangible reason that, you know, you want to ask a question, anything, you should call the judge, because it's pretty likely to reward you in that scenario.
Yeah, I had that. I did that at the GP. I'd call a judge on myself because I forgot to de-sideboard, and it was not a big deal, which was great.
Yep.
Because I did not want to accidentally cheat.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess it's... I think the shift that you're talking about is sort of like trying to move them away from being like enforcers, and more like, not that they don't enforce the rules, but that they're sort of like...
Well, that move is to incentivize people to use them, right? It's like, these judges are here. Before they were kind of like silent arbiters that would like stand over people's shoulders and people were like scared of them, right? Now it's kind of just like, judges are everybody's friend. So, you know, call them and they're going to make the situation right.
Yeah.
Right? Where if you're doing the right thing, if you're not, you know, cheating and blatantly trying to scumbag your opponent, it's going to probably be beneficial for you to call the judge, unless, you know, you did something wrong. But you know, if you did something wrong, you should probably own up to it and, you know, just deal with it, right? So it's generally better to just call the judge. And yeah, I mean, you're right. They're there to help. They want to give you correct rulings. And you know, another point that has come up recently for me, if you see something happen in a different match too, like if you are just like sitting there watching and there's something happening in a different match that you think maybe against the rules, maybe you don't agree with, maybe you thought somebody drew an extra card or they got the interaction on a card wrong or whatever, call a judge. I've had it come up twice in recent events I was in that, you know, somebody got, you know, some sort of penalty for not calling a judge and in fact interfering with the other game. And in those spots, it's just advantageous for you to call a judge before you take any sort of action.
Hmm. There you go. Yeah, don't interfere in other people's games.
I mean, that one seems obvious, but it's really easy to be like, oh, hey, you missed that trigger, you know? And it doesn't seem like a big deal, but that is a big deal to be an outside assistant in a game. So if that's the case, you know, just call a judge and ask them to, you know, maybe check if all the triggers have been, you know, caught or whatever, and maybe they'll rule that the trigger was missed, but you know, you can't really interfere with the game, but you can have a judge ask both players to, you know, make sure that the board state's correct or life totals are correct or whatever. So
there you go. Valuable information. So before we get to the spice rack, you can visit us on Facebook, facebook.com/turn1thoughtsies, all spelled out. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at @T1Thoughtsies and Zach is at @A22EN. You can see our YouTube videos, youtube.com/turn1thoughtsies, all spelled out. You can see all of our content on turn1thoughtsies.com. Thank you to our stream sponsor, cardhoarder.com. You can see the Twitch stream at twitch.tv/T1Thoughtsies. If you are listening on iTunes, please rate and review. And you picked a spice rack card this week. I will let you take it away. It is Fauna Shaman. Speaking of impactful two drops.
Okay. So for the spice rack this week, we chose Isochron Scepter. Isochron Scepter is a 2 mana, which is just 2 generic colorless mana. It's an artifact, and it has imprint, and it says, when Isochron Scepter enters the battlefield, you may remove a card, an instant card with converted mana cost 2 or less from your hand, and or you remove it from the game, but you remove it from the game and place it under Isochron Scepter, essentially. And then Isochron Scepter has 2 tap, you may cast a copy of the card exiled by Isochron Scepter. So the general idea is to put sweet 2 mana or 1 mana instants under it. A great one is Path to Exile. Path to Exile is great. It's the most played card in Modern. If you get a Path to Exile every turn, I cannot imagine your opponent being able to win through that. That sounds gross. Another really sweet one is Lightning Helix, and this is why I brought it up, is that I saw in a Jeskai control mirror one of my friends exile Lightning Helix under an Isochron Scepter post board, and the person without the Isochron Scepter did not win that
one. They didn't bring in their wear tear.
No, you don't. You typically don't bring in wear tear when your opponent doesn't have any targets for it, and that's why this is sweet. Is because it's an artifact that goes into decks that generally don't play any artifacts.
Yep, I could see that.
So they're not likely to have hate for it, and it's just like, have you ever put a remand into this? Just return your spell to your hand and draw a card every turn. Oh, it's so nice.
The only I put a hide and seek on an Isochron Scepter when that was still a thing that you could do. That was a long time ago, though.
Okay.
That is no longer the case. Sweet. You're not allowed to do that anymore.
No, it would cost too much, but it would be sweet.
So you just, it was like the dorkiest mill plan, but it was basically like strip out all of your win cons and you're like, all right, you've got 47 cards that do nothing. Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah. It was actually miserable because there was so much shuffling. It was just like, Shuffle everything. Shuffle multiple times per turn.
Oh, you know what? We could put Extirpator Surgical under our Isochron Scepter.
Also seems bad.
It's not probably not good, but It is sweet. It's spicy. Just surgical every card that goes in your opponent's graveyard. Just mill by a thousand different ways.
Hard pass.
Yeah, you should probably pass on that one. But Lightning Bolt's a great one to put under there. Lightning Bolt seems good. Yeah. You can put Spatial Contortion under there out of Eldrazi Tron if you need... I'm not sure that's generally the best way to go about this, but it is a thing.
I mean, it kills a lot of humans.
It does kill a lot of humans. It kills Manus Riders. You can put put a Gut Shot under there as Affinity. Get some repeated Gut Shot action. Sketchy. It's not great, but, you know, it's something you can do with the card. But, yeah, I think the general, you know, like, sweet way to look at it is Fogs, right? You put a Fog under there, and now they just don't. Your opponent just doesn't have a combat step the rest of the game. Which is pretty messed up.
Actually, you know what you could put under there? Oh, no, it's not instant speed. I was going to say explore, but it's not an instant. I'm sure there's...
No, explore... Yeah, explore doesn't work, but one card that is, like, pretty messed up to put under Isochron Scepter is Boomerang. Boomerang is a legal card, and you can just bounce their land every turn, which means your opponent essentially just doesn't get to play more lands for the rest of the game, which is kind of ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah, so Isochron Scepter is a silly control card. It's not particularly expensive too. I think that's if it costs 3, I don't think it would ever see any play. But like 2 mana is a nice thing.
Yep. I mean, the reason people don't play this now, the reason it sees very little play is that, you know, it gets Abrupt Decayed. So, like, if you just play Isochron Scepter on 2, exile your Lightning Helix, and they, you know, Abrupt Decay it, well, you just got 2-for-1 by an Abrupt Decay, which is not something Abrupt Decay generally does. So, you like, in that sense, it's pretty bad, but if you play it on 4, you know, you put your Helix under it, and then you get to... It has haste, essentially, because it's an artifact, so you can just play it on 4 and then tap it immediately to cast the card you exiled. So, you can get some value out of it. You can get a little bit of value right when you play it, so... It's a pretty sweet card. Definitely a fun one to bring out of the sideboard if you're playing some cheap instants. You can really get people with it, and it is really frustrating to play against when you know you don't have an answer to it in your main deck. So, it's spicy, it's fun.
There you go.
It's
worth trying. Grab one. I'm trying to think what the... Oh, there's a promo one.
Yeah, there's a promo one. It was an uncommon in Mirrodin?
Yeah.
I want to say maybe it was...
So it was...
I think it's Mirrodin. And then I think it was also an Eternal Masters?
It was. Yes, it was. That is weird. All right, so Isochron Scepter, Eternal Masters, meh. It had from the Vault art. So it was From the Vault Relics, and then it was that same art was in Eternal Masters. There was a Mirrodin and a Dual Dex Is It versus Golgari reprint, which I have to imagine came after Mirrodin. And then there's a promo version that has, like, a sweet, weird eyeball thing inside, like, a equally weird scepter, I guess, for lack of a better word. Because it...
Kind of looks like the Eye of Sauron, dude.
Yeah. Sauron. Well, it looks like the Eye of Vecna. But that is because I'm a D&D nerd, not a Lord of the Rings nerd. So, there you go. So I always think of this as the Eye of Vecna, and I'm like, so powerful. If you don't know what the Eye of Vecna is, it's V-E-C-N-A. Go look it up. It is a sick, cool old magic item from old D&D. So there you go. So thank you, everybody, for listening, and we will catch up with you next time.
Love you guys.